Has this resulted in increasing that sensitivity to people?
Well, we've called on them for some retraining. Some of them have sent some of their employees for retraining. It's the one thing it's doing this early, and it's too early to really claim anything, because we're now into the first session after its initiation. But we in all cases send this summary to the agency head. First of all, just the fact that somebody's looking that closely at your performance perks you up a bit. You do a better job when you know damn well somebody's evaluating it. And particularly when they're evaluating it in the context of dollars for your agency. So the one thing it's done already is to have agencies recycle, retrain, redefine. In some cases, it's also developed problems in executive reorganization, in defining jurisdiction. We've left gaps, so it was our fault. In those cases, we quickly moved in and introduced bills to cohese that. The whole reorganization of health and rehabilitative services is a consequence of the patternized complaints largely in that area. The difficulty in getting any answer at all in a region indicated to us a structural failure, our fault, when we compacted the multiplicity of health and personal service-oriented services into one gigantic department and put all the structure up here in Tallahassee with no real authority down here. So it's not only helping us, but it's helping them.
Now, this is the only state that's put the ombudsman function in the legislative branch, otherwise it's an executive branch.
That's right. And, of course, the problem with having it in the executive branch is like having the auditor in the executive branch. God dang auditor, he never really did a hell of a job. Same man, same staff. When we had him under the executive branch, he'd walk tippy-toe through the boss's office, you know, and if he wrote up anything, it was fairly good. Now he's busting their ass, you know, if those dollars and that statute don't match. It's just the human equation.
This is program budgeting based on client reaction, period, right?
Right,
it's not
right.
Investigatory, it's just based on reaction. That's
right. But then, when it patternizes, then we move into the investigation with the Committee of Jurisdiction, having the responsibility. We have to diffuse that, or it'll overwhelm us. And we have to be very selective. We can't take on the whole damn world in 1 year.
Is this ombudsman situation at the moment limited to the Senate only?
Yes.
Do you anticipate it will expand and become a legislative
yes.
function?
Yes. Right. I sure do, but it's first got to work. I proposed it first to be a joint legislative management deal. The fear of failure or makes us leery of trying sometimes. So I think in a couple of years, this thing will be, and the House is already using some of the data that we're developing. So I think.
How does the executive office feel about it?
They don't like it.
Send them your reports?
Yes, sir. Oh, yeah. The idea isn't to embarrass them at all, and because that isn't the role of the legislature. It is the role of the legislature to test. But the executive branch isn't going to test itself any more than I'm going to test myself.
Sort of a new dimension of the traditional concept of legislative oversight.
Right. And it's an index.
Does that result in I was George Rowney's executive assistant for program development and agency liaison 6 years, so I ran that whole thing. But doesn't it result in, instead of people coming to the executive office, the governor, more people going to the legislature? In other words, if you can get, that was a function, that casework was traditionally a function of the governor's office.
Well.
Is that shifting?
No, I think.
People still go to the governor's office?
They even still go to the division or bureau where they think they can get the service.
But when that fails.
When that fails, they'll probably go up, they'll probably try to go to the governor's office. When they don't get an answer there, then they're mad, then they go into the legislature.
You're going to the government of last resort in that case.
Right.
So after they've gone to the bureaucracy, the governor's office?
That's right. They're already half pissed off when they call our ombudsman.
But they, you think they've already exhausted those other two options by the time they get here?
In almost every case so far they have. And we don't want to discourage that.
Well, I presume then you direct the ombudsman director, you're sort of a, has to be a very special person,
yes,
right?
Yes, very special, very hard-nosed, and these people have to be very... We even are bilingual because so many of our people are Spanish. And the people that are manning the phones have a great deal of talent. We aren't just using telephone answers. They know what they're talking about. And they...
How much do you spend on that operation right now?
I don't even have a total figure broken out because I'm using the computer. I'm using our computer. Blank space, but it's considerable. Of course, we had to do some good staffing. And I'm doing it out of my governmental operations committee. So the software was exceedingly expensive. But really, it's been a worthwhile product, even if the program doesn't produce, because we do have the best index, really, the first good index of where it all happens in Florida.
So presumably, then, if you're not getting any complaints about some agency, it's a presumption they must be doing a pretty good job.
That's right. And when we get a lock, for example, about a Sunland institution, then we hired a little old employee, and we, with a good little bit of sense, because there were some accusations of all sorts of extraordinary brutality and that sort of thing, and I called Emmett Roberts, who was then the director of Health and Rehabilitative Services, and I got a little old buddy here I sure would like for you to get a job. I understand there's a vacancy in Sunland Institution out here in Tallahassee. He just needs to be an orderly. Pretty soon they hire him as an orderly. We've got him there to give us some first-hand information about, are these complaints real? To what degree are they real? And they were much more real than I would want really to believe. But then with that, we were able to get to a head of that division and say, look, you've got some terribly crusty employees. And all these stories aren't phony. We did it just that way and cleared it up.
What did they do? Did they retrain employees, fire
them? Retrained some, fired a bunch, but mainly got them a good personnel person out there that wouldn't tolerate that stuff.
Is the ombudsman title the audit function?
With what?
The audit function.
No. And with all respect to the audit type, audit is historic. It's exact. Is this check legal pursuant to this study? It's a CPA type deal, and I hope neither.
They don't do any performance kind of auditing. Was the money?
Yeah, the auditing does do some performance type too, but it's more in the fiscal area, not the efficiency and performance really. But to tell you the truth, I hope neither one of you CPAs. I love them. We can't do without them. I wouldn't want to run a business without one. But it's hard to get a CPA to move across this line and into the human equations of getting a job done. They just don't think that way. They still go into dollars and cents. And I wanted to separate them. I felt that if they got married in the beginning, it'd be just another CPA type report. And that isn't what I wanted.
What else do you think ought to be done in the legislature in terms of reform?
Well, the time thing for committees and for floor debate is the most significant. We've achieved the staffing level that we need. We've got the money to do it with. The other is purely just subjective. It just depends on how gutty your members are.
So, I want to ask you one question to make sure I understand something. You session is in effect last 2 years, or you have two sessions.
Well, we have more than that because of special session, but primarily we're set up to have two sessions, one a year.
But at the end of the second year, everything that's untouched is dead, right?
Right.
And then you start over with the new legislature mm-hmm. from scratch.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But you're saying the carryover from one session to the next is too much?
Well, it's too much for the 60-day session.
Right. Is there any thought ever been given to limiting the number of bills any member can introduce in a session?
Yeah, that's an alternative. That would certainly help. I don't know constitutionally how you. I guess if the courts construed that as a procedural thing, it would be rulemaking and under our. The trouble is that you have 20-25% out there that are competent and able to handle a lot more, and you'd be limiting them, and it has some weak points, but.
Can you limit the right of a member to express what he wants to do?
That's what I'm talking about. That's the constitutional constraint. And when that became the vogue around here, I asked, how do you tell one constituency? They may be in such a situation of flux that their whole ideas and concepts are wanting to test everything we've got, and they may demand that their senator introduce 25 or 30 bills. And the guy that's effective out there, and a real mover and a charger, he's going to be sought for an introducer. But somehow, by God, that bill crunch is the problem there. But I don't know how you can just tell one you can't introduce but three bills or four bills. Constitutional, because it isn't him that you're limiting, it's whatever constituency he represents.
If you meet with your colleagues from other state legislatures, do you find the kind of ferment form and so on there that you find here that's occurred in the last 8 years?
For the most part, I mean, it's not as rare as it was during the preceding decade. Few states where it's as compelling as it is here. Most
in
of
the South?
In
the South? Do you find any in the South? States like this?
Not really.
But we haven't found
any. No, I haven't. I haven't South. But there are a few states nationally that really are driving to fight the battle, of dying legislatures.
Now, a lot of this is due, of course, to reapportionment. But was a lot of it due also to the group that came out of World War II, went to the University of Florida,
I put more of it on that than I do reapportionment.
Yourself,
because much of this stuff began to start. Sam, I told somebody yesterday, he said, well, you can put all of this at the hands of reapportionment. I said, name me one that originated since then, that where the growing pressure originated in. That's untrue. Constitutional revision, we were driving for that, and I was on the first Constitutional Advisory Commission in 1955. That's almost 20 years ago. Executive reorganization began in 1957 with a bunch of hardheads, some of them are in Congress now. They couldn't stand the fact that nobody really knew where everything happened. We had 210 boards, bureaus, and commissions, and nobody knew who was doing what. We were appropriating money to them. So the idea for executive reorganization began then. And really, but to mess with the machinery of the executive branch was such a terrible fight, because when you mess with that power index, you've got a war. So finally, to do it, we in 63, and this was before massive reapportionment, in 63 we just simply created the Executive Reorganization Commission, put top people on it, and put them to work. It wasn't just legislature, it was a little bit of everybody, but we told them that we wanted to compact the executive branch of government into 25 or less departments. And they spent 3 or 4 years doing that in 68. That was the fruition of it. So people, I think, have unfairly said that because it happened in 68, that it was after the massive reapportionment. That really has been a fair statement, in my opinion. The zeal picked up some because there were more members interested in the result. But it was that breed of independent, scrapping, scratching guy that wasn't going to be dictated to. After World War II, brand new college degrees, idealistic, his own man, that began all of that. And we began messing with the judicial branch. First major amendment to Article 5 was done in 1955. Not 68 or 70. It was 71 before we completely rewrote the entirety of our court system from a structural point of view. So, no, I don't, and I find just as many weak sisters.
You think it was all there, it was just accelerated by the reapportionment?
Yeah, and I find just as many weak sisters politically today as there were then. Some of these guys just, a headline can hit or an editorial hit and they run into the role. That's not necessarily bad, but it is if that's the only criteria. I find just as many of them today as I did then. And I find just as many guys like Jim Williams here from Ocala and Louis Delaparte, who you could put a whole governor and cabinet and every newspaper in the state on him, and he thought he was convicted. You've got him to fight tomorrow. He's like a burrowing nematode. He just might slow him down, but you're not going to stop him. So, and he was there.
Are there more of those kind of men coming up?
There are always some of those men. But
you don't think this period was dominated by?
I don't think the proportion is any greater.
Okay.
The impatience of Sam Gibbons, who manned Congress, the impatience of Bill Chappell. That's easier to do it today for some reason. I don't know how to value it, but.
Does the press of this state have anything to do with that?
Yes.
And the Capitol Press Corps?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Yes, I wouldn't know how to assess that in rank of importance, but I think it has.
What would you change in the other branches, the executive branch in particular?
Well,
you know, taking the cabinet system.
The one thing I've learned in government, this is where I disagree with the textbook classic governmentalists. The one thing I have learned just from my own is that, that people can't stand power. And I believe in every instance, even at the risk of some efficiency, to diffuse it, the absolute of power. So I like the cabinet system. I would have them meet more frequently. I think it's more public. I think on the major policy of the state, I worry a hell of a lot about the easy movement in government is subsurfacial to the elected official. So I really am opposed to the absolute power being in any governor. You might have an exceedingly good one, but even then, absolute power just cripples a good man. But more importantly than that, one man can only reasonably exercise wise dominion over a limited amount of jurisdiction, whether that's business or whatever. And then the thing that I really fear the most is that those people who make government happen, and this predominates at the federal level, I think, they function and make decisions without anybody seeing it or feeling it until it's fact accomplished. So I like our cabinet system. It's it may be slow and tedious, but from an administrative point of view, it's wise. So the only thing I would do is to have them, they're killing themselves in this state by being inept as a cabinet. The cabinet's gone through some remarkable change. A lot of new people, and it's become more a matter of autonomous units than a cohesive cabinet. And frankly, I think that's been encouraged by the governor, who no governor would like the cabinet system after he gets there. Most of them have liked it before. But for example, he's encouraged them to only meet every other week. And I think that was a tragic beginning of the end of the cabinet system in Florida. But the real evils that have occurred in a lot of other states have occurred not because he necessarily had a bad governor, but because he was in control of such a vast empire that self-executed in so many sensitive areas where he had no knowledge and no way of having knowledge. And those people function outside of the public arena, and they make decisions without the public being even reasonably a part of them. But what I would change in the executive branch is I would love to see the governor and the cabinet produce its own real ongoing testing thing. The motivation of government is really counterproductive. It's to hire more people, to build more empires, to have more people dispersed around the state for political organizational reasons, and they just, it lacks, so the legislature's got to supply it. It lacks the motivation to perform efficiently in the most expedient form and efficient form and inexpensive form. That is the basis, compelling basis for almost every other thing except government. And it goes in the other direction, naturally. And I would be no different. If I was head of the Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services, I'd hire as many people as I could hire, and I know that. I think it's a human equation. I'd build an empire if somebody would let me. And that's the thing that I've learned out of 20 years of government. So I don't trust government. I don't trust me. Unchecked, and I don't trust Reuben Askew unchecked, because that power puts a man in the frame of mind that he cannot stand divergence of opinion. And I watched it happen to Reuben, even with the power we had. The give and take of Askew as a senator and the give and take of Askew as a governor, boy, he almost recriminatory when someone bucks an idea. That happens to people with absolute power. So that's what I've learned, and I think it's legislative role to perform that function of testing. I use the expression that people become uncomfortable when the governor and the cabinet and the legislature quarrel, and I become uncomfortable when they're in a love fest. I guess that sums that up.
Why do you want to be a United States Senator?
I don't know. You know, I surely wouldn't want to be governor or cabinet member or judge. The conflict in my mind is that I really wanted to get back into my business. And up until February 1st, I was heading there pretty dramatically. Rebuilt another business to go back to, as a matter of fact. I started and built a life insurance company to head in Tampa that I now have to grab some new leadership for. But I love the legislative business. I love the fight, the difference of opinion, the reconciliation of philosophic differences. That's just part of me. And the idea of all of a sudden of not being involved in that probably stirred whatever there is about us that's a virus. And decided if there was anything else that I ever wanted, it would be the Congress. And I think, oddly enough, that they're everything that I don't like about a legislature. I think they've lost, really, their tie. I think they're as ill-equipped today as we were 25, 30 years ago. I think they're just like the cabinet. A senator up there has a fine staff, a lot of people to help him, but he's so patronage and constituent-oriented that it's hard for him to be a viable part of a whole. And I don't see the U.S. Senate as really a whole. I hope I'm wrong. And you aren't supposed to be concerned about anything except what comes before your committee, and the seniority system pisses me off. That's a bad way to run a battleship. And maybe they do
you
like.
You want to go up there and raise a little hell? Is that it?
Well, yeah, I don't want to not raise hell. And really, if it's as bad as I think it is, I'm not going to run again. If all I'm going to be is a letter writer, if I get there, and I've got a 25% chance of getting there, if all I'm going to be is a letter writer and a post office originator.
You think some of the reforms like the Sunshine Law and the way you operate and organize this legislation would help the Congress?
Damn sure couldn't hurt him any. And yes, I do. They can't find a bill. You know, one of them, and they do every night, call me, and I can pluck out here and tell them where a house bill is and whether it's been amended and find out in seconds.
That's a computer console, right?
Yeah.
It ties you into what?
To the legislative computer. In a second, I can recall a bill's current status. Well, the same thing. You call a member of the United States Senate, and if he can give you a current status on a bill in less than 4 days, it's because he's handling
it. Can you
it.
Just demonstrate that for us
yeah.
just a minute? I'd just like to see.
Serious candidates against you?
Well, no.
Three?
Three serious candidates. And all pretty... we're hard to forecast. And I guess that's because we're sort of a melting pot, really. We've assimilated so much of the national population by infusion that... we really are, in some sections, typical Midwestern conservatives, and we're typical Northeastern liberals, and we view government from that vantage point. And you can sit out there and watch this appropriations bill this afternoon and feel it. So forecasting a Florida election is tough. Being in one's even tougher. So I don't know, you know, the... I think any one of the four, there are several others, but none of them are making any waves. I think any one of the four could by a combination of fortuitous circumstances, put together a winning campaign.
How would Governor Askew fare in a head-on presidential primary in Florida against George Wallace?
Against George Wallace? That's a hell of a good question. George Wallace was high man before. You know, I never have had that put to me quite like that.
Let's assume Askew gets reelected governor
by a substantial
margin.
He's going to get reelected by a substantial margin. He's got more trouble than he thinks he has. But it's with the people that's organized for him that feel he's been rather aloof, and he has. But being governor makes you be rather aloof. You can't spend the time. But people that have been his organization around the state in large numbers aren't his organization anymore. He's replaced that with an extremely strong, popular image with people that don't know anything about politics and don't give a damn. That's really a strange thing to move around and see that's what happened. I'm not even sure that Rubin realizes this. Let me punctuate that. I was in Broward County the other night. 400 or 500 people. People that had organized it for me. And they were standing, one of them was standing at the door with me greeting people as they came in. And as that began to subside and parties separate and mellow out, having a drink or two, Guy says, you know, I was Rubin's campaign manager in Broward County last year. Yeah, really? And he started calling over people, and he called all but two of the committee last time. And this isn't much of a compliment to me, but they're using my race as an excuse not to screw with Askew. But in that same county, too.
Why?
One, he wouldn't communicate with him, wouldn't talk to him. Being with him was a neuter. He's very, very objective. He leans completely on staff and staff evaluation of what's right and wrong in his opinion, which is great. But committees like to be talked to and listened to about particularly patronage. Who's going to be this, that, and the other, who isn't. But in that same county, I would venture to say that Askew would get a 70% vote or better against anybody that ran against him in the Democratic primary. Now, that doesn't answer your question.
Well, I keep pondering his question, but how do you explain that phenomenon? 70% of Broward County would vote for him, really no matter what.
Because of what I just said, that he had replaced the typical extension of a candidate from an organizational point of view, which is the basic way. It's the way I've got to do it, because I don't have that image.
How do you think, getting back to my question?
Yeah, I am. But he's replaced that with an image that's pleasing to people. No specific.
You mean free of organization?
Yes, free of organization. The name Askew has become symbolic with fairness and honesty. And for the most part, he's been that. So he's earned it. So he's replaced typical campaigning. And he'd have to really screw up.